Views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
Ooh.
Hey.
It was Big Bill to you.
Yes.
Oh, no, that's Big Bill to me.
That's right.
Anyway, we've been absent. Sorry. It's been stuff. It's summertime. It's stuff. And next week, more stuff. I don't know. Seems to be a lot of it these days. Seems like the whole world's gone a little bit bananas. Darn, should have brought you some fun letters I've received of late. I could have read them to you on the air while we were waiting to connect with our guest. Good times. Oh, boy. So let's see. I need to be able to get into my stupid computer. Here we go. All right. Our first guest is going to be Land Rich, Cash Poor author. His name is Brian Reisinger. And the subtitle of the book is My Family's Hope and the Untold History of the Disappearing American Farmer. And I think we always hear a lot about that. But we're not getting him on the phone. So I'll tell you a little bit about him in the hopes that we do get him. And I debated on how to say his county name, Sauk. How do you say it, Bill? What's your name?
Sauk.
I think it's Sauk.
Sauk?
Yeah. I looked it up. You know how there's always a thing that says how you say stuff? Yeah. Like I had differing opinions on this. But he grew up on a family farm in Sauk County, Sauk. And then sometimes they spelled it Sac. That didn't help me either. That's in Wisconsin, actually. And it says, and lives to tell the hidden stories of rural America. So apparently growing up on a family farm had peril.
Yeah.
Who knew? He is a columnist and a consultant. He worked with his father from the time he could walk before entering the worlds of business, journalism, and public policy. He's been published by USA Today, Newsweek, Yahoo News, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, USA Today, PBS, the ever-vanishing PBS, and Public Radio's Wisconsin Life. He's kind of been all over there. He's been in The Hill, The Capital Times, Saving Country Music, and many other news, policy, outdoor, and cultural publications. His writing has won awards from the National Society of Newspaper Columnists, first place in the Seven Hills Literary Contest. And he lives with his wife and daughter and serves as president and chief content officer of Midwestern-based Platform Communications, splitting time between a small town in Northern California. We're in Northern California. And Southern Wisconsin. And Land Rich, Cash Poor is his first book. And he's actually on the line. So, Brian, you now get to solve the riddle of how you pronounce your county. Is it Sauk?
It is Sauk County. You got it exactly right.
Yes. Because sometimes they spelled it S-A-U-K and then they spelled it S-A-C. And I'm like, if it's S-A-C, it's Sack. But that's not right. Yeah. Anyway, I left the possibilities open, but I was pretty good on Sauk.
That is pretty good. You know, I actually, either one would have worked because you mentioned I split my time when I'm in Wisconsin. I'm in Sauk County. When I'm in California, I'm actually in the Sacramento area. So Sauk, you throw whatever you want.
Oh, my gosh. Well, isn't that handy? And by the way, Sacramento isn't really Northern California. We're in real Northern California. If you want to drive a few hours north, you can come and visit us.
I would love to do that.
In regular Northern California, actually. And, and you could avoid the whole stoplight situation, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, Sacramento's gotten really, really, really busy. I don't know.
Very congested.
Maybe it was
now.
Always busy, but it just seems busier now.
Yeah. I hear that. I prefer the surrounding farmland myself. So.
Yeah, no kidding. You do have a lot of good country up there if you, you know, head to the east or, you know, just a little bit north, and there's some space. Just get out of town.
Absolutely.
So we're open. How do you want to start today? Because we have a lot of agricultural issues up there. We cover a lot of them on our show because a lot of our country up here is agriculture. And just in case we run out of time, I want to know at the outset, do you guys have issues with wolves where you are?
Yeah, you know, we have them a little bit further north of the farm where I grew up, but they are coming our way. So I'm in southwestern Wisconsin, and in central and northern Wisconsin, they have a really serious wolf issue, killing calves, injuring livestock in other ways, endangering humans, endangering loggers as well as farmers and ranchers. I'm a little further south, but the issue is getting worse and worse. We're starting to wonder if we're going to start to see wolves in addition to the coyotes and everything that we've got down there in the southern part of the state. So,
yeah, nobody in agricultural world is immune from that, it seems. I do know that federally, the delisting process shouldn't be too painful if we can get ourselves the, well, our dreams are about the appointee for Fish and Wildlife, because his nickname is the Wolf Killer. And that's not our nickname for him. That was actually his nickname when he worked in Wyoming Fish and Game. So,
well, it's a crucial issue. I mean, it is a matter of safety, but it's a matter also of honestly economic prosperity, because people who are in the logging agriculture industries can't operate in places where the wolves are all that heavy. And you can have a balanced ecosystem, or however they want to look at it. You can have conservation. Wolves can be part of a healthy, you know, woodland, but they can't be completely unregulated. And you know, you got to have sensible policies around that stuff.
Yeah, and we don't out here. I don't know what your state are you state listed out there?
Yeah, so in Wisconsin, they've gone back and forth. When it was delisted and there was Republican leadership in the state, they began to set up a wolf hunt. And then there was Democratic leadership in the state, and then it has, of course, flip-flopped back and forth whether it's delisted or not. So Wisconsin had a brief hunt, and then the door was slammed shut, and it's kind of been a back-and-forth fight where not only loggers and farmers and ranchers, but hunters don't really know what the situation is supposed to be, you know, moment to moment, honestly.
Yeah, that's the, out here they are listed, and that is part of our problem, because they claim that they're managing it, but the management is wolves get to do whatever they want, and people are restricted from contact.
Right.
And wolves are pretty sharp, you know, they figure out right away, like, oh, those guys can't hurt us at all, let's get closer, you know, why run for food when we can walk?
Yeah, exactly.
So much better. So, what prompted you to write your book, just out of curiosity?
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. You know, I grew up with this issue from the very beginning. When I was a little kid growing up working with my dad, the time I could walk, I had, you know, people be driving into our driveway talking to my dad about this farm went under, this farm disappeared. So I knew farms were disappearing. I knew I was very lucky to be growing up on a small family farm. What I didn't know was why they're disappearing, what was happening. And as I got older and pursued a writing career, first in journalism, then in public policy, I wanted to answer that question, why are our farms disappearing? So I started investigating that, and what I found was a 100-year history, hidden eras of history going back 100 years that have driven the disappearance of our farms and affected our food supply and our economy and the cost of our food and the help of so many other issues. And I decided to weave that with my family story because I found that the two went hand in hand, some ways good ways, some ways bad ways. You know, I saw ways, for example, that my grandfather lived through 2 decades of economic depression, and while the country was dealing with the Great Depression, what that did to our farms and our agriculture and our system of government, my grandpa was just trying to get by, climb out of poverty in the middle class. And so there were all these moments from that time period on up through my dad and mom and my sister and me growing up in globalization and the recession of the 2000s, where that hidden history of our disappearing farms, the impact it's having, track my family's story, and so I ended up kind of coming across it in that fashion.
Hmm. That makes sense. And do you see that as a common thread throughout the agricultural communities in the country? I mean, when you hear reports of what's going on in other places, it's like, mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we were a dairy farm for more than 100 years. We milked cows, and we don't milk cows anymore. My dad is still farming, and my sister's work take over the farm. We sold the cows because we would have had to get way bigger. And some people do that, and that's up to them. And for us, it wasn't what we wanted to do, so we diversified, and we raise custom. We raise heifers for other dairy farms. We raise beef for consumers. We raise cash crops. But we're still a small farm that has a lot of the same roots as we always did. What I found as I investigated these issues is that farms are dealing with the same issues across the country. Different types of farming are very different, yes, but there were three big issues that drove the disappearance of our farms and have made our food supply expensive, unhealthy, and insecure. And those issues were economic crises that we didn't understand the way they're affecting farms, governmental policy by both parties over the decades that have caused problems and made them worse, and then technology that has moved agriculture forward but also has needlessly left so many of our family farms behind. Those three issues affect every single size and type of farm in the country. So while we tell a personal, raw, and honest story as much as we can about my family, we're talking about issues that affect our entire food supply and all the farms that power it.
Yeah, and about the technology, like what type of technology are we talking about?
Yeah, so what we really need in this country that we lost track of is something called scale-neutral technology, and that's technology that could work for small and mid-sized farms as well as large farms. And so if you think about, like, all the machinery out there that just has more and more and more and more field rows for machinery or buildings that hold more and more and more animals, that's fine. That's needed for a type of agriculture and a type of farm. But it isn't something that's practical. You can't use it on farms of all sizes, and not all farms of all sizes can afford it. And so you've got farms that are perfectly competitive, perfectly adaptable, perfectly efficient, but most of the technology being produced isn't affordable for them or wouldn't work on their facility. And so we lost sight of that. In dairy, the big industry, or the big example that we had was my mom and dad were living through the farm crisis, fighting their way through the farm crisis and a drought, and on top of it, our herd at the time got sickened with mastitis, which is an infection that can spoil the milk and sicken the cow and endanger their health, and it was about to wipe out their herd. Well, they installed what's known as a pipeline. That pipeline took the milk right from the cow's udder into the cooling tank in the milk house. That was an innovation that you could do. You could do a big pipeline for a big farm. You could do a small pipeline for a small farm. That was an innovation that made sense for farms of all sizes, and my mom and dad had to pay money to do it. They had to finance it. It stretched their budget, but they were able to do it, and the efficiency paid for itself in a couple of years. Now, if you want to deal with an issue like that in dairy, you really have to go from a small milk barn to a great big milking parlor, you know. So we lost sight of that pipeline was an example of scale neutral. We lost sight of that. We only have technology mainly that is driving farmers have to get bigger, and that's on top of all the other economic forces already driving them to do that.
Yeah, we see that in the logging industry as well. I mean, it used to be you had logging crews out in the woods, a lot of guys on the ground, cutting trees, you know, bumping the knots and that sort of thing. And now it's all mechanized. And these machines, you know, are starting at around $500,000 and up. And small loggers, went away. They couldn't afford that. And so they basically went out of business, and you're left with only the loggers that can afford the million-dollar machines and that sort of thing.
Right, and they could be perfectly efficient and just as adaptable, and they might be the kind of loggers that could do certain types of jobs for people that some of the bigger ones won't do. You know what I mean? There could still be a place in the market for them. There could still be a need for them. But because of that technology driving that scale, it wipes out more and more small businesses. So, in that way, technology has needlessly left behind a lot of really good farms, you know, tens of thousands, in fact.
Well, and people talk all the time about how, you know, they hate all this, you know, corporate farming and all this stuff and how everything should be small. And yet the regulatory environment that they support by the people they elect crush them.
That's right. Well, you know, and that gets into the other thing I mentioned. It was technology, economic crises, and government policies. You hit on it exactly right. Government policies, whether it is regulation, whether it's taxation, here's what happens. A lot of times those policies aren't conceived with, you know, the family farmer in mind at all. Mm-hmm. But if they are conceived with the family farmer in mind, sometimes it is by policymakers that think that, you know, okay, we're going to go after the big guys, we're going to go after the corporate guys, whatever it is. Okay, well, whether you agree with that or not, here's what happens. The taxes and those regulations go in place, and it's the small farms, the independent farmer, the mom-and-pop shop, it's the same thing with every single industry, that gets hit the hardest. And the reason for that is they don't have the army of lobbyists to help shape the policy in ways that secretly helps them in the first place, And then they don't have the army of lawyers and accountants to help them figure out how to navigate all these issues to, you know, kind of dull the blow. And they don't have the big capital reserves to absorb it. So whatever industry it is, but especially with farming, if you do craft policies with farms in mind, you think you're going to go after the big guys, you end up hitting the small guys harder because they don't have the tools and resources to be able to deal with it in the same way.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the kicker, is that they kind of get cut off at the knees. And same, too, with just even basic things that I think people wouldn't even realize if you're not in that type of industry. But simple things like reporting. You know, just even your water usage have to be online. All these things have to be done online. And so the world that lives in, you know, urban America, no problem. Online, for the most part, works. But in rural America, that sometimes is spotty or unavailable.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Sometimes, exactly. Too, you know, like we back to the wolf thing, because it's just such a big deal up here. It's everywhere, but we're dealing with it a lot here, unsuccessfully. And so they supposedly, you know, they collar these wolves, which, of course, makes them go closer to humans because they have to keep catching them and changing the batteries. But that aside, it's supposed to be so they can notify farmers and ranchers when they're near their livestock and animals and workers and pets and whatever. But those delays are oftentimes hours or days before they get any of that information. So it's of no value to them.
Yep, exactly. And that's what ends up happening is, you know, I mean, we, and, you know, it really gets at a deeper issue, I think, that is wound into what you're saying, which is that people who live and work close to the land, whether it's farmers, whether it's ranchers, whether it's loggers, you know, these are the kinds of people who know and understand our natural resources the best and care about them the most. You know, I hear people who care about our environment all the time who end up being at odds with farmers, and I just think about that, and I think, you know, there's no reason for that. Farmers are some of the original conservationists. You want to figure out a solution to have healthy soil. You want to have a solution to have abundant supplies of clean drinking water. Work together with farmers on that. And there are people who are trying to find ways, bipartisan legislation and other things, to try to find ways to work with farmers on conservation. And they're there to do it, you know, and that's where the real work on these issues is being done. And I think that if we can expand that and have more agreement between people who care about our environment and people who work in our environment, we can do more about it. But if we keep being at odds, we're just going to have a zero-sum game and we're not going to accomplish anything.
Sure. Yeah, because the people who have worked this land, I mean, if you're going to work land for 100 years and you intend to keep going, destroying it isn't, that actually isn't your goal. We have to take a really quick break. We're going to be back with our guest, Brian. And now, Brian, I said your last name was Reisinger. Is that correct?
You got that right, too.
Oh, my God. I'm a thousand. Bill Kirpin's on next hour. I'm probably going to ball that one up. but you get a pass today. Farming wins. Yay. So you're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. And here's our favorite song for the wolves.
Ow! Who said I see walking in these woods? Why, it's Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red Riding Hood. You sure are looking good. You're everything a big bad wolf could want. Listen to me, Little Red Riding Hood.
It was on the streets of Pinar del Rio. You remember the smell of her hair. You thought, white gardenias. You shared dinner, then coffee. Then came that beautiful aroma of the cigar. You forgot her name, but not the cigar. La Roma de Cuba, mi amor. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
This season, Hunter Roofing is stepping up to the plate. As proud sponsors of Colt 45's baseball, we're cheering on every home run and keeping your home protected. From storm repairs to full replacements, trust the pros who bring quality to every job. Hunter Roofing, where quality meets the sky. Support local, keep your home in winning shape, and root for the Colt 45s. Visit hunterroofing.org today.
Now is a great time to prepare for the upcoming wildfire season. REU and city staff are busy clearing vegetation to mitigate wildfire risks to our power lines, facilities, and the community. You can also prepare by trimming back shrubs and tree branches that are closer than 5 feet from your home. Clear debris from your roof and gutter and clear dead vegetation on your property. For information about tree trimming and proximity to power lines, call 530-224-4356. Please remember, we all need to work together to prevent wildfires in our community.
Hey, Redding, save big on Black Bear Diner's new basket bundles. Get your paws on a choice of sandwich, side, and drink for only $11. A great meal at a great price. Basket bundles, now available at Black Bear Diner. Be sure to stop by for breakfast, lunch, or dinner. Black Bear Diner just added 4 brand new and 4 returning classics to the menu. Black Bear Diner, 2205 Hilltop Drive. Get big value and so many choices at Black Bear Diner.
Black Bear Diner.
Couple guys in first class on a flight from New York to Los Angeles. Kind of making small talk, killing time, flirting with the flight attendants. 30,000 feet above could be Oklahoma. Just a bunch of square cornfields and wheat farms, man, it all looks the same. Miles and miles of back roads and highways connecting little towns with funny names. Who wanna live down there in the middle of nowhere? They've never drove through Indiana. Met the man who plowed that earth, planted that seed, but in his ass for you and me. You're gonna harvest moon in Kansas. They'd understand why God made those flowers.
Couldn't let a show on farming go without the Flyover State song. Oh, and it uses a bad word. Ooh. Oh, it's okay.
It's an agricultural term.
Nice. I like it. All right. So, Brian, in your book, for the people who... So let's pretend that people don't know anything about agriculture. Maybe they don't care. Why do you, I mean, well, spoiler alert, we want them to read your book first, actually. So, but, you know, what we want isn't always what we get. Why is this appealing, or how is this appealing to people outside the world of agriculture, maybe folks who don't know anything about that, besides the fact they might smarten up?
Absolutely. You know, that's an issue that we take on head on with the book because it was unavoidable. As we were telling stories about our family surviving farm accidents and weather that blesses and threatens and years of economic upheaval, things, kinds of things that farm families face, not only is there a human drama there that, you know, my hope is that people appreciate an honest story about that, those kind of challenges, but the impact that the loss of our farms is having has a direct impact on our food supply. Mm-hmm. And so anybody who doesn't necessarily have an interest in farming or rural America, this is a story of how the hollowing out of rural America is affecting every single American dinner table. And the fact is that we've been losing farms at the rate of 45,000 a year on average for the past century, 45,000 a year. And what that means is it has led to food that is more expensive, food that is less healthy, and food that is less secure. So anybody during COVID or bird flu who couldn't find the food that they need in the grocery store, if they could, the price was through the roof, or anybody who's worried about, you know, what they're putting in their body or where their food comes from, or anybody who's worried about, you know, any number of national security issues or anything else, all these things are affected by the loss of our farms. And then it goes further than that. The core of it is the food supply, but it goes toward environmental issues, mental health issues. There's so many things streaming through our, not only our economy, but our culture that are happening because we're losing the American farmer at such a terrifying rate.
Yeah, I think that is obviously a story worth telling, because if anyone thinks that by crushing the American farmer, we're going to have better national security, you know, a better national security position. I mean, it all falls apart when you can't feed your own people.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It gets at our most fundamental form of security, you know, food security. If you mm-hmm. think, what is more basic than that? You know, I mean, food and shelter, those are the first two things humans need, and we don't realize that we're hollowing out our ability to do that. We have a 42, in the years between, the time between the Biden administration and the Trump administration kind of went into that no man's land, you know,
mm-hmm.
We had an agricultural trade deficit of $42.5 billion, $42.5 billion. That means that we are importing $42.5 billion more in food and agricultural products than we're exporting. We're doing that at the same time that we're wiping out our farms at 45,000 a year. That almost reads like the script to a doomsday movie, you know. I mean, you're wiping out
yeah.
your food supply and depending on foreign adversaries, really. I mean, it's a really big problem. And then it extends even deeper into national security, to your point, because so much of our farmland is becoming vulnerable to purchase by the Chinese Communist Party and other foreign adversaries. And there are many things driving that, but one thing driving it is the loss of our farms, because as more and more farmland is owned by a large corporation that really all they owe their shareholders is a good return on their investment, it's much easier to sell a big piece of land to a foreign adversary in that situation. Try walking up to your average American farmer, walking up onto their porch and saying, I'm from the Chinese Communist Party and I'm here to buy your farm. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
You know? So family farms are the best guard against foreign adversaries getting their hands on our farmland and farmland that's near military installations.
True.
How do you feel about the whole tariff thing? Do you think that's going to help or hurt the farms?
You know, it's a good question. There's a path through it where we're in a time in our history where if we can have situations where we put family farms first in our trade, we can really revolutionize things. And here's why you hear people kind of debating the farm thing. On the one hand, farmers of all types and sizes have been getting screwed by unfair trade practices for decades. The 90s and the early 2000s, some of that trade was good, some of it was really bad, and it was just freewheeling. And so there was unfair trade practices that led to a lot of things harming the American farmer. At the same time, you do hear agricultural groups and some farmers say, hey, I do need to be able to export some of my products. And if we're in a fight with every single country and they're retaliating with tariffs on us, that makes it harder to sell our goods. So both things are true for the farmer. But here's the thing. We can wipe out unfair trade standards and open up new markets by drawing some of these hard lines. And so when you see the trade deal with the UK that the Trump administration arranged, when you see some of these others like with Japan, the more that we can draw a hard line and open up a market that's going to be fair, the better off we're going to be. So we can't, you know, just let other countries take advantage of us like was happening for decades. And we can't just shut down trade. So we need to open up fair markets with tough negotiations. And, you know, I think that there's a real chance to do that at this point in time. So I think the American farmer is watching, you know, nervous, but also with the belief that, you know, more fair trade, tougher trade negotiations can be a good thing if we can pull off. We just got to make sure that we get a result.
Well, this morning, and I don't, maybe it happened yesterday, I don't know what the timeline was on the news, but it looked like it was today, that it was a 15% reciprocal trade negotiated with the EU. And there was quite a bit of agriculture included in that package. They didn't go into the detail, but I thought, hey, that bodes well for everything here, because there are a lot of things those guys can't grow.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, the EU is the latest example. I mentioned the UK, I mentioned Japan, and there's also Indonesia. There was a lot of talks going on with India. There were even talks going on off and on at various points with China. Here's what we need to do. Those big trading partners that are being unfair to us, China and others, we got to be tough. We got to push. We got to make sure that we're going to lead to some real serious change where they're going to stop the currency manipulation. They're going to stop buying up a bunch of American agriculture products and then dumping them to depress the price, all kinds of things that those big trading partners do. So we got to take those folks on, make sure that if we're doing business with them, they're going to be fair to the American farmer, the American worker. And then we also need to open up trade with a lot of small countries all across the globe. Here's something that shocked me when I was investigating trade issues and how they are affecting our farm as well as other farms across the country. In 2022, we only had trade agreements with about 20 countries. And that kind of blows people's mind. But
wow.
It's big trade agreements. Yeah, it was big trade agreements with like China, Canada, Mexico, and basically our governments from decades past kind of gave away the farm. So we had like 20 trade agreements that were like super loose and lax, right? So imagine if instead of that, we had hundreds of trade agreements that were nice and tough, you know? So that's a way to increase trade and make sure that the American farmer, the American worker, the American manufacturer isn't getting his way.
When we talk about food security and national security and all that, we do have a swath of people in the country with zero experience in agriculture, actually, who believe that they could just kind of go out and buy a place with some ground and grow all their own food.
Right.
Yeah. Just from your experience, what's the prognosis on that?
You know, anybody who wants to go work the land, I say more power to you. The reality is that we can't feed our country that way, you know. And there's a reason that we progressed from every single person in this country being a farmer to the vast majority not being, which is that we needed other people in this economy to do other things, to manufacture goods, you know, to all kinds of things. So that issue, it's a good hobby. I wish people well who are growing their own food and growing it from the ground. I mean, I think that's great, but it's not going to solve the bigger issue, right?
And you're not going to grow the range of food that's going to keep you, A, alive and B, healthy. I guess maybe healthy and then alive. That's just not possible in your backyard. I was just going to say, I mean, you might augment your world with, you know, some tomatoes and stuff like that. But for heaven's sakes, you're not going to grow enough to have a well-balanced diet.
That's right. And, you know, we agree that, like, on the one hand, that isn't going to solve the issue. I think a lot of us all agree that, on the other hand, bigger, even the farms that are having to get bigger, they're just doing it because they need to do that to stay afloat, you know. So I think we agree that, on the other hand, just bigger and bigger on into eternity also doesn't work.
Correct.
You know, if we lose 45,000 farms a year going forward like we have for the past century, we're going to lose the rest of our farms by the time in 40 years. So by the time my little girl, I'm 40 now, by the time my little girl is my age, we'll have lost the rest of our farms if we don't change course. So we can't have everyone growing their own food on the one hand, and we can't have just, you know, farms that eventually it just gets to a point of being too big to fail. So what's the answer? The answer is to find out a way for our family farms to have new entrepreneurial opportunity in this country to be able to move forward. That's the only path.
Yeah, and in one of the comments that I read, I don't know if it was from you or someone about your book, but it spoke about the cultural crisis that threatens the food supply. And so what does the cultural crisis look like from your vantage point?
Yeah, you know, as I was investigating this, I saw ways that my own life growing up on the farm mirrored some really big things about our country. I mean, I grew up, you know, getting up with my dad, son up, you know, we would, if there was a cow who was hard at labor, having a hard time delivering her calf, we'd come and we'd help her deliver, and I would see that calf, you know, draw its first breaths. In the spring, I'd see my dad plant crops, and in the fall, I'd see God's miracles. So working close to animals, working close to the land, you see things like values like hard work. You see things like the circle of life. You see God's miracles, you know, all of these things. And that's what I grew up with. But as I looked at it, you know, there's a reason that Thomas Jefferson all the way back was talking about the yeoman farmer being one of the main building blocks of our country, you know, and it has to do with values. So it's not only our economy and affecting the price and the health and the security of everyone's food, but it's also affecting who we are as people. We're not just losing the farms that feed us. We're losing a part of ourselves along the way.
Yeah. It's a true story. I don't think people realize that if you have crops or animals, actually, you don't get to just, everybody goes on vacation. It doesn't really work like that.
Yeah, it's a way of life, you know. I mean, you know, my dad, we tell this story in the book, my dad, when he was at the tender age of 8, his dad, my grandpa, slipped off the corn crib and fell 30 feet and broke his back. And he did get back up on his feet, but not before my dad at the age of 8 took on the work of a man, and he never really stopped. You know, so he's 73 now, so he's been doing that for well over 60 years, dang near 65 years. And that's hardship for a child. That's challenging. And we want to tell that story in an honest way. But also, you know, my dad isn't on the back of a tractor right now. He's running on his 2 knee replacements to get to one. I can guarantee you that he loves it. It's down into his blood and his bones. And so that beauty and that hardship really goes hand in hand. And, you know, we have all these farm families, even though we've lost 70% of our farms, we've got nearly 2 million farm families left that still want to work that hard to feed our country. And we've done all these things that have deliberately made the economics not work for them. Imagine what they could accomplish if we made it work again.
Yeah. We have to take a really quick break again, but when we come back, highlight the types of things that the regulatory things. I'd like to go through some of that because I don't think people really understand the regulatory crush that's on farming. It depends on where you live, but it all kind of paints the same picture. So our guest is the author of Land Rich, Cash Poor. His name is Brian Reisinger. I hope you stick with us. We are at wethepeopleradio.us. There you go. Got your job back, Bill.
Oh, thanks.
A sweet old lady was 84 when her kin folks came for a month or more. Now from overwork, she's on the other shore. Much too late was y'all come back. And it says in the farmer's almanac, it says, visitors and fish smell after 3 days. Our leader was a silver-tongued man. He deceived the people of the land. And when he got caught, he couldn't stand. It's a little offbeat and a little off track, but it says in the farmer's almanac, it says, in rivers and bad government, the lightest things float to the top.
For over 50 years, House of Realty has provided experienced and effective advice to its real estate clients. Experts in residential, commercial, and investment property, we have the knowledge and tools to assist you with all of your real estate needs. Family owned and operated since 1965, we have been an active part of the Shasta County community for generations. Please call House of Realty today at 241-8300. A reputation for excellence since 1965.
Need help with your health insurance? We've got you covered. At Shasta Community Health Center, we offer this free service to our community. Our enrollment counselors can assist you with new applications, renewals, troubleshooting, and answering your questions about covered California plans or Medi-Cal, also known as Medicaid or Partnership Health Plan. We're here to help you make the best choice for you and your family. Call our outreach and enrollment team at 530-229-5117 to get help today. Shasta Community Health Center, because SCHC cares.
Hi, it's Mark from Haven Humane Society. Are you looking to add to your family? We have puppies, kittens, small critters, and farm animals. Each year, we have thousands of amazing animals looking for homes come into our lives, and we hope to have them join yours. Follow us on social media and find our links on our website at havenhumane.org. Watch our weekly content on YouTube, like our Mark's Monday mashup, when we talk about what's going on and introduce you to our team and adoptable animals. Get involved. Volunteer. Thank you for all your continued support. Together, we are moving closer to our ultimate goal of a North State with no more homeless pets.
Owners, landlords, and tenants trust Authority Property Management at 2663 Victor Avenue. They manage a variety of properties, including single-family homes, apartments, condos, townhouses, multifamily properties, and commercial properties. Authority Property Management offers full-time management, including finding and screening tenants, rent collection, financial reporting, and final walkthrough home inspections when they move out. Contact Authority Property Management today at 530-410-6085 and check out their website at authoritypm.com.
I hear the same propaganda day after day. It's getting so hip to knock the USA. If we're so awful and we're so bad, you ought to check the nightlife and live.
What do you bookend Johnny Cash with? Glenn Frey, of course.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, so Brian, when we get to the regulatory stuff, what are the kinds of things that become, over time, maybe not the first shot, but over time they become insurmountable and just crush a basic family farm?
Absolutely. You're asking a crucial question. You know, there's nothing better than tuning in to radio on a Sunday afternoon and hearing Johnny Cash, in my opinion. And, you know, the man in black kind of had it right in this case. There's a lyric in that song that says, in rivers and bad government, light things float to the top.
I knew you liked that part.
it couldn't be more right. There's such a wide range of issues, local, state, and federal. The first is there's a wide range of regulations on what you can and can't do with your own land, what kind of crops you are and aren't able to put in. There's incredible amount of regulations on what you can and can't sell if you're growing fresh local food. There's a lot of limitations on what you can sell, even though, you know, there's a lot of hyper-processed food coming from some of the biggest companies in this country that are really bad for us, you know. So there's limitations on what you can do with your land. There's limitations on what you can sell. And then there's just also incredible regulatory burdens that just would crush, again, particularly the smallest farmers. And a really good example of that is this Waters of the United States rule. I'm sure you've read about it, talked about it at different times. You know, they wanted to take what was a navigable water and change the definition, and they wanted to apply this policy so that, you know, basically like the little, you know, the little cow pond, the little creek running out back of the farmyard is a navigable water. Like, you know, as far as I'm concerned, if you can't, last time I checked, if you can't put a canoe through it, it's not navigable, you know.
Yeah, right.
And these are the kinds of regulations that lead to government having a heavy hand, not only in what people can do, but what it will cost. And our family farms, when they are going year after year, decade after decade of farming, getting harder and harder, prices increasing, and what they're getting for the goods not increasing, so their margins are getting tighter. They can't afford a, you know, you have the government come in and say you got to make this $20,000, $30,000 change to your land. They didn't have that in their budget. That's enough to put them under in some cases. So it's those kinds of things that have piled up, and it's really decade after decade of government layering things on without taking a look at any of our programs. This is true also of our taxes and our subsidies. You know, what's working, what isn't, what's contradictory, what's become prone to favoritism and abuse. We haven't undergone a period of reform to do anything about this stuff in a very long time.
No. And like what we see up here, we have a section in Northern California, and basically, they want to steal these guys' water, and the river is fully adjudicated. So what the state has done is put drought restriction on them. Well, flooded most of the winter, and so obviously the drought was way over. But they have been under drought restriction for several years.
Yeah.
And
well, you know,
I've got farmers like up on the Klamath, where the Bureau of Reclamation steals their water every year and claims it's for the Endangered Species Act, although the law says that they have to buy that water if they want to use it for ESA. They don't. They take it, and the farmers have sued in federal court, but the court won't make a decision, so they have basically lost because it just sits on the docket. So
yeah. Somehow it's not okay for us to use water for small businesses in agriculture who want to feed the rest of our country, but it is okay to use water to just spray endlessly to water our lawn in places where you really can't have a lawn because of the heat. You know, I mean, we're just taking a resource that we're not allowing people to do something productive with, and we're just
well,
like, and that's what makes people so mad.
Out here, I don't, maybe Wisconsin, when they're wasting their water in Wisconsin, I'm curious what they're doing with it, because here, wasting water here, 50% of California's water gets flushed out to the ocean for, quote, environmental purposes.
Incredible.
AKA fish. So when you're blowing that much water for, you know, fish, do you guys have the fish thing where you are? Fish are the excuse for everything here.
It's amazing.
Just,
you know, we don't have that, but there are so many fights about so much water that isn't being utilized. You know, just the concept of a dam is somehow an affront to an environment when, you know, having a dam can, one, generate clean power, but two, allow you to utilize the water flow in some areas when they need it. In other words, where you can't, in other words, you can deal with drought, you know, you can deal with flooding, you can help so many things, but doing something like that is just an affront to the environment, even though it can help that environment. It's just incredible.
Earlier, you had mentioned you spend time in Sacramento. A lot of the land around Sacramento, I notice, is being developed. A lot of the farmland is being developed into housing tracts, commercial real estate, shopping centers, that sort of thing. When these small family farms don't make it, Do you know what the numbers are as far as how much of that land actually goes back into farming with, say, bigger corporate farms, or how much of it is developed into, you know, housing and commercial property?
It's such a great question. For the first half of this crisis, which is to say the first half of the 20th century, we started losing farms actually in the 1920s before the Great Depression, because what I found when I was investigating that time period in my family's history, there was an agriculture depression that hit the rural parts of the country before 10 years before the Great Depression. So that started in the 1920s. From the 1920s up to the 1960s, the amount of farmland was mostly the same, which is to say farms were going under, and they were getting bought up by other farms, or they were consolidating into larger farms, and you weren't really changing the amount of farmland. That really began to change in the 1950s and 60s. You started seeing airports and urban sprawl and commercial real estate developments and all these things beginning to gobble it up, and we have been losing the amount of farmland that we've been doing. We're not losing the amount of farmland as quickly as we're losing farms, because we're losing farms to development, but also to consolidation within the industry and that kind of thing. But for the second half of the 20th century, we have been losing farmland too. And so it's basically, the answer is it's all of these things. It's farms being wiped out of existence by development. It's farms being combined with other farms that had to get bigger to try to survive. It's families. But along the way, it's families either going bankrupt or being forced to sell when they don't want to, you know. And that's what's been happening now for decades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm always amazed at how many acres of farmland are disappearing around the Sacramento area. I mean, it's got to be in the thousands of acres. You travel that area now, and you just see nothing but earth movers and excavators and pipelines, and I mean, it's just massive growth going on. And that
in beautiful farmland.
It used to be farmland, yeah, all farmland. There was nothing but farmland out there, and now it's like you say, the urban sprawl is just moving at an incredible rate. Do you see a lot of that out there where you are?
Yeah, we do. We see it all around Sacramento, and then, you know, when I'm back home in southern Wisconsin, I'm back and forth, not quite, but nearly every month. And so I spend a lot of time, and I live out at the farm when I'm in Wisconsin. And we see it there, too, in terms of Milwaukee and Madison spreading. You got Madison spreading ever and ever westward, in our case, closer and closer to the Sauk and Dane County border. And you got a lot of people moving from Dane County out to Sauk County. And so we see that sprawl. And you know, it's just hard. It's heartbreaking. You see a lot of dormant farms giving way where the family, well, that's the definition. This is why the book was titled Land Rich Cash Poor. We grew up with this dilemma. You know, you have land that is worth so much if you're willing to sell it, and you've got land that is so hard to make a living on if you stay on it. And so you got families that are grinding on a living year after year, you know, hardly, you know, getting by, and they want to keep going because it's their, not only your job, but it's your home, it's your community, it's your way of life, it's your heritage, you know. And you can either keep going until you can't make a living and you might lose everything, or you can turn around and sell that land, but when you do it, you lose everything else. And that's really the dilemma that farm families face in this country.
I've noticed there's, and I don't know what the trend is where you are, but the trend for a long time was leave the farm, don't go back. That seems to be shifting a little bit.
I think you're absolutely right. Now, I'm an example here. You know, I grew up, I had a lot more talent for words and writing than I did cattle and crops. Mm-hmm. And I work with my family on the business side of the farm. And when I'm back, my mom and dad and sister, they throw me in a tractor, and I help out like any farm kid. There's no such thing as a day off. But it was my sister who had the talent for cattle and crops. And so while she worked to take over the farm, I worked to find my own career. And that's why this, you know, the book and my columns of writing about these issues is so dear to me. I see my role partially also about talking about these issues, telling our story, and I'm honored to do it. But I'm an example of someone who wrestled with that. You know, what do you do? And the reality is there are so many young people in this country who would farm if they saw a brighter economic light. You know, they don't have guidance counselors telling them, hey, why don't you go farm with dad or grandpa or your uncle down the road? That'd be a good future for you. You know, they don't get told that. So these kids who have the talent, they either go into other parts of agriculture, or they go into the trades, or they go into the military, or maybe they go to college. Those are all noble things to do. But a lot of them would stay and farm if they thought they could have a go of it and have a career. They're trying to figure out what to do with their lives, and they got all these adults telling them, and nobody's telling them that farming would be a good idea, right? So you got a lot of young people who would do that. And then you have a lot of people from the city who, especially during COVID, left, but they began to see that, man, you know, they don't have to have their work tied to that city. They want to get out of that way of life. They want to get back to the land. So there's a lot of people in rural America who would farm, and a lot of people in urban areas who want to return to the land. I think it goes back to what we were talking about. People know that we're losing a part of ourselves. They may not say it that way. They may not put their finger on it, but they know they're missing something.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And we did see that a lot up here. You probably saw it where you were in Wisconsin, too. I don't know how your land is situated, but we're dotted with a lot of small towns up here. And we saw a real influx in a lot of our small towns with people from the city.
Yeah, absolutely. We see that all over in Wisconsin, people coming back. And look, I mean, you'll get all kinds of good and bad with all kinds of different trends. But one thing that I say is, you know, in places that communities how to harness that, you know, people coming in also means more money and more ideas, you know. And so there are some rural communities. There's Potosi, Wisconsin, where I'm from. There's all kinds of places that have found a way, whether it's tourism, whether it's a unique industry that they have, some way to let entrepreneurship sprout, you know. When you have people coming into an area, it is an opportunity. And rural America was being depopulated for decades. That began in the 40s. And so to have some people coming back, that's ultimately a good thing. Even if it can lead to some raised eyebrows at the diner in the morning over a cup of coffee, it's a good thing to have people coming back into the community, because that means money, that means growth and opportunity.
Yeah, that's a really good point. In Wisconsin, what's the reception for people who are kind of fleeing to the rural places but don't come from there and have no, you know what I mean, have no background? Is that kind of like, oh dear, more city people?
Yeah, it's a mixed bag, right? You can imagine.
Yeah.
So whether it's at the diner or whether it's on the bar stool,
there's a lot of
frustration with people who come in from out of town who kind of act like they own the place and don't really know or respect the people, and you'll get some of that. And that's a people problem sometimes. And then, of course, it can drive up property values and taxation levels.
Yep.
And, you know, so there's real problems that it can lead to. But when there's an opportunity, when people who come to a rural area who are respectful and want to know the community that they're planning to live in or that they're visiting, and you got people who are welcoming in a community, which most small towns are, you get an opportunity for people to learn about each other. And you find ways that, you know, that new family that lived in Chicago but really does care about the local community can come and has an idea for a small business that's going to grow and create some jobs. You know, there's opportunity for that kind of thing. You know, there's no question that there's some well-founded eye-rolling that goes on along the way, too. But my hope is that people can find a way to understand each other, and people come in those communities can do it with a tone of respect, you know.
Yeah, and go there to learn something. It's interesting. I was talking to somebody, and some folks bought, like, 5 acres out where he is, and he's out there a ways. And so they bought all these chickens. They've got kids, and they bought all these chickens. And isn't it going to be magical? Well, they let the chickens, you know, free range. Well, that was nice, but they all became, you know, coyote food. So they free ranged once. That was kind of the end of that. There's a lot to be learned when you move out into a place like that. And I do think it's interesting. It is mixing things up. Maybe that divide will lessen, and we'll see that in our also in our decision making and our politics. So it's not quite so bad. I found a song for your dad that we can go out with, and we really appreciate having you on here, Brian. I think that rural America deserves to be defended, and you know, things like your book and people who have this vantage point are somewhat unique in the world.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that so much. I'd like to think so, and you know, anybody who cares about these issues, cares about these stories, I just deeply appreciate it. My Enrich Cash Poor is available on Amazon, anywhere else you buy books online. It's also available in bookstores nationwide. And we got paperback coming out in September. It's available for pre-order. And, you know, my big thing is just anybody who cares about their food or where it comes from or cares about rural America, well, just spread the word and try to shine
Absolutely.
A light on these issues like you guys are.
All right. Yeah. Land Rich, Cash Poor. And here we go.
Thanks
for Brian's dad.
Brian.
Nothing left for my kids and my wife. Oh, I clung to that first cup of coffee.
praying, God, won't you show me what's real? Out in the distance, I saw through the window a man on a tractor with a dog in a field. Oh, the dog walked just like he was smiling. The man drove like the world was all right.
K243 CT Reading.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice.
News this hour from townhall.com. I'm Jason Walker. United States and the EU have agreed to a trade deal setting a 15% tariff on most goods. That announcement today preventing higher import taxes on both sides that could have sent shockwaves around the world. President Trump and European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen's private meeting culminated months of times at the bargain table. And speaking of money, President Trump says Japan has given him, as part of a new trade framework, $550 billion to invest in the United States. It is, however, still subject to negotiation. The president says 90% of any profits from that deal invested would go to the United States, calling it a, quote, signing bonus. Also at townhall.com, former Missouri GOP Senator Jim Talent says it's very likely the Senate Majority Leader will be forced to delay breaking for the August recess as Democrats refuse to confirm key Trump nominees.
What I think they ought to do is, what if I had to guess, Thune will do, which is he'll keep them in, moving nominations for a few days, and eventually the Democrats will come to some kind of an agreement. And they'll get a number of the non-controversial nominees, and then they can go home.
And he says Majority Leader John Thune will have to play his cards very carefully if he hopes to confirm Trump nominees and also allow members to break for the recess.
Now, the constraint on Thune here is if Republicans start to leave, because, of course, he's got to have the votes on the floor. So he's got to make certain that he can hold 51 votes in Washington. But I feel pretty sure he can do that.
Very hot and muggy conditions still in the southeast and parts of the Midwest. More on these stories at townhall.com.
Living with everyday pain is like having a voice that always says, no, no, you can't do that. You can't go there. You can't play your favorite sport. You better sit this one out. It's no way to live. If pain is affecting you, see how Relief Factor can help you get back to living life again on your terms. One where you say yes a whole lot more. Head over to ReliefFactor.com or give them a call at 800-4-RELIEF. Relief Factor is a daily supplement that fights pain naturally. Developed by a team of doctors and scientists, Relief Factor's unique formula of natural ingredients doesn't just mask pain, it helps reduce or eliminate it for good. Whether it's your back, neck, your joints, your muscles, Relief Factor can help you, as it has for so many others. Give Relief Factor's 3-week quick start a try. It's only $19.95, a low-cost way for you to sort of take it out for a test drive. Less than a dollar a day. Go to ReliefFactor.com, ReliefFactor.com, or call 800-4-RELIEF. That's 800-4-RELIEF. See how you could live with less pain, and you can say yes to more of everything you want with Relief Factor.
Millions of people living in mobile home parks apparently do not enjoy the same drinking water protections that Americans are accustomed to.
A review by the Associated Press found that nearly 70% of mobile home parks that run their own water systems violated safe drinking water rules over a recent 5-year stretch. That's a higher rate than utilities that supply waters for cities and towns. And it's impossible to know the full extent of the problem. That's because the parks commonly aren't identified in the EPA's National Database for Drinking Water Violations. John Scott reporting.
Michigan authorities say a suspect remains in custody following the stabbing incident yesterday in a Walmart in Traverse City. The county sheriff's office says a 42-year-old man entered the store and used a folding knife to stab 11 people. 6 are in critical condition, 5 serious. Breaking news and analysis, townhall.com. Heritage Foundation economist E.J. Antoni says the past 4 years of Biden policies, including sky-high inflation, leaving many young workers to lose 20% of their value of their savings.
Meanwhile, we've seen home prices absolutely explode. We've seen the interest rates on mortgages also hit the highest in literally decades. So all of this combines to create a situation where young people simply can't get ahead.
He says the dream of home ownership seems out of reach for many young people.
Because now they can't even save more money for a down payment on a house because their rent is so high, their groceries are so high, their transportation costs, their insurance is so high, etc. Young folks today are basically just on a treadmill.
It's a massive deal. FCC has given a green light to an $8 billion merger of Paramount Global and Skydance Media. More on these stories, townhall.com.
The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
No. Welcome back to the second hour of We the People. Phil didn't have his headset on. He's like, I have an upset stomach. I'm like, the microphone is on.
You're giving me an upset stomach.
More buffoonery.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. It's July 27th, 2025, just in case you wanted to know when the buffoonery was taking place. Oh, and our guest this hour, we saw him on Fox a little while ago, and you know, I bet Griff Jenkins knows when his microphone is on.
He's a professional.
Poor Phil. He's been relegated to the cheap seats now. Oh, Bill and Aaron's clown car. Oh, my God. Phil Kirpin. He is awesome. And, you know, I noticed he doesn't speak as quickly on TV as he does on radio, so I'm kind of excited because he really kicks it up a notch for us.
That's right.
He's a leading free market.
Well, it's the big show.
The really big show. A leading free market policy analyst and advocate in Washington, D.C. That's probably why he had to slow down the talking, because there's all that Washington, D.C. humidity. He's a principal policy and legislative strategist at Americans for Prosperity for over 5 years. Previously worked in the Free Enterprise Fund, the Club for Growth, and the Cato Institute. He's also nationally syndicated as a columnist and chairman of the Internet Freedom Coalition and author of the 2011 book, Democracy Denied. Currently, he's the president of American Commitment, dedicated to restoring and protecting the American commitment to free markets, economic growth, constitutionally limited government, property rights, and individual freedom. How do you go wrong there? You can find their website at AmericanCommitment.org. And kind of up for discussion today is the whole thing about tariffs. And with all these announcements this morning.
Perfect timing.
We saw him on TV. I'm like, Shazam. And then Bill bungles the lead. All right, Bill, if it's not too embarrassing, go ahead and fire off.
I don't know. That was quite an introduction. I like it. You guys are like trying not to crack up laughing. I like it. I mean, it's interesting because I don't even remember. I was supposed to talk about something else, and I'm in the Fox Green Room, and then it's like Trump's on there announcing a deal. I'm like, so I'm probably going to be talking about this instead. So
yeah, I wondered about that. I was like, that seems like real time.
Well, you know what I was really thinking? Like, is Trump going to bump me? Am I going to lose my segment here? Talking too long?
I'm going to get stuck with Bill and Aaron. Dang it.
No, but I think, you know, I used to be on Fox a lot. Like, during COVID, I was on, like, once a week at least. And then I was like, COVID's over. They think I'm the COVID guy. I'm never getting another call from them. But, you know, once in a while, they remember me. And I still go back over there. So today was one of those days.
No, today it was funny because I thought, I guess he'll be all warmed up to talk about whatever's going on. So... It was interesting.
It's about 100 degrees here, so it's too warm.
Sorry. Yeah, warmed up is.
Yeah, I heard that yesterday. They had like 100 degrees in D.C. It was that's got to be brutal with the humidity.
We've hit triple digits like every day for the past week. Yeah. And then you know we get all these thunderstorms and all the trees are down and all this stuff.
What's the humidity back there?
85.
I don't know, 1,000,000%.
Yeah, right.
Sweaty.
Like you're walking, you're cutting through a swamp. I mean, it's like you're like, you can like feel the air.
Yeah.
I don't miss any of that, actually. Don't miss it at all.
nobody comes here for the weather, let me put it that
way. No, and it's really funny because they're not in session during August. It's like, gee, I wonder when that tradition started.
You're right. Well, I mean, the thing, I think the founders, they were very smart. They were like, let's put the national capital in this filthy swamp. No one will want to spend any time in, and then the government will stay small. But then what they didn't count on was air conditioning.
Right.
And now the government's grown out of control.
Yeah. Air conditioning solves a multitude of sins, but not all of them.
There's a lot of upside. I mean, we get tens of thousands of heat deaths a year in Europe because they don't have air conditioning. We don't get that in this country. So,
you know, true story.
It's not bad. Not bad. Not too bad to have AC when you need it.
Oh, man.
Anyway, I'm way off on a tangent.
We started on a tangent. Well, we were going to talk about, like, the tariffs and things, actually my note says, up for discussion today, with the passage of the Big Beautiful Bill, the Trump tax cuts of 2017 have been extended while eliminating taxes on tips and overtime, but America's budget deficits and national debt remain a problem. Unemployment and inflation numbers remain steady while the Fed is still poised to continue cutting interest rates. What's the outlook for American growth, and what impact will the Trump tariffs have on the economy? that's what you were teed up for.
Well, there we go. That's actually perfect then.
Yeah.
I'll have to tell Stephen Manfredi, who writes these pitches, that he nailed it.
God bless him. Perfect. He's the best. I love getting his emails.
He's really good. He is really good. He's been with me for a long time too. He does a great job. We've got a lot of really good ingredients for a strong economy. We're not quite seeing it yet, but, you know, all the pieces are sort of falling into place, I think, for us to have real strong economic growth. And, of course, you know, we had three really good years at the beginning of the last Trump presidency, and then everything went off the rails with the lockdowns and all of that. We had a horrible last year, of course, and then, you know, kind of Biden continued a lot of bad policies. But I think we're kind of getting the elements back in place to get really strong economic growth again. We've got really good energy policy. We've got really good deregulation. We've got pretty good tax policy now, especially canceling that huge tax hike that was supposed to come at the end of the year, bringing back 100% expensing for investment in, you know, equipment and software, and now for certain production facilities as well. You know, the big sort of uncertainty, the big kind of storm cloud economically, was how all these kind of trade wars were going to be resolved, and you know, we're staring down this August 1st deadline, and you know, we now have deals with our most significant trading partners, right? We've got Canada and Mexico. You know, they're going to have a sort of a headline tariff rate, but most of the stuff is exempt under USMCA. We've now got a deal with Japan at 15%. We've got a deal with the UK at 10%. We've got the big one now, the deal with Europe at 15%. And so, you know, I would love zero, but I think that the view of this current administration is, you know, let's kind of get a 10 to 15% baseline kind of a tariff on all of our trade around the world and have that do a lot of the weight of raising revenue to offset the tax cuts on all the, you know, all the other taxes that we want to bring down. And, you know, a revenue tariff, you know, consistent pretty much across the board at a relatively low rate, it's not the worst thing in the world. It's not going to have a huge distortive impact on trade the way, you know, the 30, 40, 50% tariffs the president talked about would. And it'll bring in, you know, trillions of dollars in revenue. You know, as long as those are used to cut other taxes, it's not going to be an increased burden on the economy. And so I think that's kind of where we're headed. And I think that, you know, if we get these deals, you know, all actually finalized and signed on the dotted line, you know, we're going to lift the major source of uncertainty from this economy. And I do think we're going to see a lot more capital investment come off the sidelines, including, you know, a lot of foreign direct investment as sort of part of these deals, and that's going to raise productivity, and it's going to raise real wages. And so my outlook is pretty positive. Now, I will say on the employment data, we've continued to have this pretty big sort of, you know, under-the-hood issue with the employment, that the sectors that have been growing have been the government and healthcare, and not a lot growing in other areas. And, of course, you know, we want to see improvement in manufacturing and construction and, you know, sort of a lot of the in more productive sectors of the economy. But I do think we're going to see that as capital investment rises, and we're already starting to see that in the last couple of reports. And so I think the ingredients are generally pretty good to have a strong economy. Of course, now you mentioned there in the intro, the one big problem that we have is the deficit outlook. And, you know, related to that, if we don't get some discipline on the spending side,
It's hard to bring down long-term inflation expectations. That means it's hard to bring down long-term interest rates. And, you know, that has implications for housing affordability and everything else. And you were playing that clip from my friend DJ Antoni. And, you know, we've got a sort of a, in a lot of parts of the country now, we have sort of a two-tiered economy. We have the people who were already in houses when prices went crazy, and the people who weren't and now think they're never going to be able to. And so that's not great. And, you know, I think that we need to see, we need to see a lot of the urban planning policies reformed because the biggest driver of housing unaffordability are urban growth boundaries. And so you can't build beyond a certain point, and then you have this artificial scarcity and prices go crazy. The cities that don't have that, for the most part, you know, they still have housing prices around three times median income, sort of the normal historical rule. But the places where supply is artificially restricted, you know, it's gone haywire, and it's been, you know, brutal, and a lot of people have been priced out. So, I mean, I think that if we can get some of those policies loosened at the local level, that would be great. If we can't, people are going to keep leaving those areas for places that have more rational policies. But, you know, the one thing that's been missing, and the one thing that I'm really hoping we can see progress on in the fall, is some discipline on federal spending. And if we could get that, if we can get federal spending a little bit under control, you don't even really need to cut it. Just stop it from growing uncontrollably while you have a growing economy, and you can kind of grow your way out of it. But if, you know, if the government always grows when the economy grows,
yeah,
it just
right.
keeps, you know, the ball keeps getting pushed the wrong direction. And so that's, I think, going to be the big challenge, is getting some discipline on spending. Both parties have shown sort of a general inability to do that. But, you know, baby steps. They did cancel $9 billion of spending for PBS and NPR and crazy foreign aid stuff. And, you know, the president's supposedly going to send up another package next. We'll see what's in that. But that's the missing ingredient. But I'm getting more optimistic that the trade conflicts can be resolved in a productive, positive way. And I think domestic tax policy looks pretty good right now. And regulatory policy and energy policy look great under this administration. So we've got a lot of really good things, at least on the federal level. Now, you've got all of the crazy California things to deal with, too. So
I was going to say,
on the national level doesn't necessarily mean you've got policy there. But my outlook is generally pretty positive right now.
Yeah, it's interesting when people in your state are wishing that the federal government could come in and take a heavier hand.
Yeah. Well, you got to love it.
Like, how screwed up is that?
Trump ended your internal combustion vehicle ban for you, so that was good.
Yeah, no
but,
kidding.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sad thing when you need the federal government to save you from your own state.
Yeah, and, you know, and in fairness, like, the people in California, when they say stuff like that, I always remind them. I'm like, hey, we're in a state with a you know, messed up two-thirds supermajority Democrat legislature and a governor who obviously is completely off the rails. But if we lived in a great state and the federal government was off the rails, we wouldn't want them rolling in and crushing our state. So, I mean, it's bad that they can't help us, but it's good they can't help us.
I hate to scare you, but I think he could end up the president because every time I watch this guy speak, he lies with such perfect confidence.
Yeah,
I mean,
he does.
It's unbelievable. I mean, he looks like he's got total command, that he knows, and he just lies, and he has the ability to do it with, like, total poison confidence, which,
except for the hand gestures that they mock him around like
for. Mobile in politics.
Yeah, except for the hand gestures. If he doesn't get that under the control.
Is that the secret?
Yeah, he's that's pretty bad. They mock him incessantly about the hand gestures. It's just
to watch for that, because I watch this guy and I think, oh, my God, everything he's saying is false, but he sounds so good doing it. I don't know.
Well, you would like to think that you know, he's got a run on his record, which is horrible, but you know, if history is a lesson, people don't remember. You know, they don't look back and they don't care about that stuff. They just like the look. You know, and he's very smooth, very slick, maybe too slick. But
I saw this clip of him where he was talking about how, like, hey, my policies must be great because we've got positive population growth the last 2 years. And it's all of that is from immigration. All of it.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a huge out migration of Americans. And, you know, you're replacing them and then some with mostly illegal immigrants, and, like, that's supposed to prove that your state is great? I'm like, I don't. But the way he said it, if you didn't know any better, you'd watch that. Oh, I don't know. This guy sounds good. I mean,
I know. It is kind of terrifying. Trust me, for the people who live here, it's kind of terrifying. But, you know, we had the ability to recall him. And a lot of people who would have voted him out didn't bother to vote because they believed that it didn't matter. Oh, they're just going to cheat. It doesn't matter. I'm still bitter about that. I'll be bitter about that until I'm really old, because I'm old now, but I'm not really old.
Well, that voting base, a large part of that voting base got burned out of their houses in Southern California. And
well, there's that, too.
They're not very happy with him, but they were the ones that kept him in office. And now that it affects them, we got to get rid of this guy. Well, yeah, we've been saying that for a long time.
I saw a story the other day that so far the county of Los Angeles has issued 7 permits to rebuild.
Yes, yes.
Seven.
Yeah.
Yeah, that land is sitting down there pretty much like it was right after the fire. There's been no progress on it at all. And I don't know if you heard about that.
But you remember all the headlines about how, oh, we're going to be rebuilt fast, we're going to wave all the red tape, and then you're like, then they've done nothing. Nothing.
Well, they did fire aid, you know, and they raised $100 million with fire aid, and then they found out that it all went to these left-wing nonprofit organizations, and none of it went to any of the fire victims.
So you can't build if they won't issue a permit.
No.
What in the world is going on there?
No, yeah. When that was all happening, all the memes were about, you know, wait till they meet the Coastal Commission. Now the people who live within their grasp are going to see.
Well, if you think back, if you remember back, they said that they're going to waive a lot of that regulatory stuff to get the building going, and they didn't do any of it.
We knew that would never happen because we see it up here. We have fires up here all the time. We've lost many, many towns in Northern California, and
the
regulatory crush then rolls in, and now your house is going to be. Santa Rosa saw that, actually. That was kind of one of the early harbingers, because they were not insured for the replacement of their foundations. And once the foundations were destroyed, they were in, I remember at that time somebody had said they needed to come up with another $60,000 to redo their foundation on this one particular house that this lady was talking about. And she said, how are we going to do that? And it was apparently not part of our fire insurance. So, I mean, there are a lot of factors that go into all this, but our fires are caused by policy. Lightning and policy, when they come together, it's very explosive. We have to take a really quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Phil Kirpin, hot off the Fox News Hour this morning. Boom, directly into the fire with us. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Health insurance? We've got you covered. At Shasta Community Health Center, we offer this free service to our community. Our enrollment counselors can assist you with new applications, renewals, troubleshooting, and answering your questions about covered California plans or Medi-Cal, also known as Medicaid or Partnership Health Plan. We're here to help you make the best choice for you and your family. Call our outreach and enrollment team at 530-229-5117 to get help today. Shasta Community Health Center, because SCHC cares.
When it comes to quality lighting and electrical work, experience matters. Ed & Sons Electric has been in business for over 20 years, helping homeowners and businesses stay safe. From installing modern light fixtures to replacing outdated outlets, we ensure your home or office is functional, efficient, and up to code. Planning a new build? Don't leave your electrical work to chance. We'll help you design a layout and put outlets where you actually need them, and lighting that enhances every space. Ed & Sons Electric specializes in all aspects of commercial electrical work, including emergency power systems,
large equipment installations, and overhead lighting solutions that meet today's standards for energy efficiency and safety. We take pride in our workmanship, our reliability, and our reputation. Call Ed, Nathan, and Justin at Ed & Sons Electric today for a free local estimate. 530-227-1553. That's 530-227-1553.
At Stifel Nicolaus, I am committed to offering investors personalized investment guidance. Stifel is a full-service organization with department staff with professionals that specialize in a wide range of investment opportunities. We strive to give each account, regardless of size, careful individual attention. This is financial advisor Susan Eastman at 530-244-7199. Let's talk today about a personalized plan. Again, that number,
530-244-7199. In case you missed the open mic moment, Bill hates this song.
I'm gonna have to take over.
My God, what the heck is happening today? Ugh. All right, back where we were, Phil. Back in the quagmire that is a regulatory burden where nothing ever gets done in California. But what's the outlook?
Well,
the
national regulatory outlook,
yeah,
is really good. It's really good. I got to say. You know, one thing that Trump was very, very effective on in his first term that I don't think got nearly as much attention as, you know, all the headline-grabbing scandals and all the shenanigans, and is he really did repeal a lot of federal regulation. And we had, under Obama, a massive increase in federal regulatory
yes.
burdens on the order of $40,000 per household or so. And Trump was net deregulatory. Which has almost never happened, even with Republican presidents, which is that the federal regulatory burden actually declined in the Trump presidency. The amazing thing and the insane thing to me, because I thought Obama's record was going to stand for a long time, Biden was worse on regulation even than Obama. He was the all-time worst.
That's sad.
And, yeah, it's hard to do. I didn't think, yeah. I mean, I was like, wow, I didn't think that could be done. But, yeah, he blew right past it. He basically put back all the Obama regulations and a lot more. And Trump is now in the process of reversing all of them again. And, in fact, he's being even more aggressive than his first term. His first term, he had a rule that for every one new regulation that came in, you had to get rid of at least two old ones. This term, his rule is for every one new regulation, you have to get rid of at least 10 old ones. And so he's pretty dramatically leaned into deregulation. And there's a, you'll see these press releases like, you know, EPA announced 37 rules that they're repealing, and, you know, we're going to see one of the biggest ones next week when they're expected to repeal the carbon dioxide endangerment finding, which is sort of the predicate for all of their greenhouse gas regulations. So that's going to be a big fight and a very worthwhile thing to do. But, you know, like the Labor Department did a press release for getting rid of 50 regulations. I don't know the exact numbers, but every department has these big numbers of regulations that they're getting rid of. And that's very pro-growth. That's very positive for the economy. The vast majority of these rules do almost nothing beneficial, and they're very expensive to comply with. And,
yeah.
They sort of add up to a huge cumulative burden on, you know, businesses, large and small, and on households, because it drives up the price of everything. And, you know, one of the disappointments in the Big Beautiful Bill, though, is, we've talked before on your show about the RAINS Act, but, you know, for anyone who's not familiar, this is a bill that basically would say for any new regulations that an agency wants, if they're significant, if they have a major impact, they can't just impose them directly. Instead, they've got to send them up to Congress for a vote and actually get approval of the House and Senate before they can take effect. And I really, really, really want to get this done before the end of Trump's term, because otherwise the next Democratic administration will just be like Biden coming in, and they'll just bring back everything that we had under Obama and Biden and then some, and they'll be able to do it very, very quickly. But if you had this process where you have to have votes in Congress, frankly, even if you have Democratic majorities, you know, they're never going to have huge supermajorities like you guys are dealing with out there. And so, you know, we'd be able to stop the bad, the really bad ones, the worst, just by bringing political pressure to bear. And I always remind people that when the Democrats had huge majorities under Reid and Pelosi with Obama, they could never get their cap-and-trade bill through Congress. I mean, they barely got it through the House. The Senate never even voted on it, even though there were 60 Democratic senators. And if we had a properly functioning system, that would have been the end of the story. None of that stuff ever would have happened. Instead, Obama said, oh, I have a pen and a phone. I'm going to have the EPA implement as much of this bill as they can, you know, figure out creative ways to, you know, write them into old laws. And, you know, they probably implemented, you know, 60 or 70% of what was in the bill that never passed, and just through, you know, agency actions and regulations. And, you know, if we had a requirement that those be sent up to Congress, none of it would have happened, because we know they didn't have the votes in Congress, even with big Democratic majorities. So this idea of requiring approval in Congress is so important because it'll stop this pendulum from swinging, and we'd have many fewer regulations. The ones we do have would be, you know, much better, I think, because they'd be subject to the actual and correct legislative process of getting majorities. And so I really want to see that happen. Senator Mike Lee tried like six different versions of it, and the Senate parliamentarian shot them all down. I don't understand Senate rules, honestly. I thought there should be some way to write it that would have been considered budgetary in nature, because the best estimate I saw from the Heritage Foundation was that this would reduce federal budget deficits by over $1 trillion over 10 years.
My understanding was the holdup was that it had to be discretionary spending in that particular bill.
Well, I think it's the opposite. It's supposed to not be discretionary, but I don't know. I mean, the thing is, the Senate rules don't make sense to anybody, except apparently this woman who's the parliamentarian, who's the queen of the world and tells people what can and can't be in there. But somehow when Biden was in, they were able to put, you know, everything they ever wanted in the Inflation Reduction Act, and that was all fine with her. So I don't know. I mean, the thing is, a lot of people say we should have fired her.
It was just that it was a reconciliation bill, and because of the type of bill, it changed. It changed the type of spending that they could include. But and there was a big push. You know, people were saying, "Oh, we need to get rid of the parliamentarian and abdicate on the rules and stuff." And it's like, you know,
the thing is, I'm not sure if it's her or if it's just the rules are weird. That's the thing. I mean,
it's,
you know, I remember in 2001, when we were doing the Bush tax cut, we were trying to get the parliamentarian to say that we could permanently repeal the federal estate tax. And the guy at the time was a guy named Robert Dove. He would not agree with it. He said, you can repeal it inside the budget window, but that's it. And so we ended up, you might remember this, it was repealed for 1 year only in 2009. Which, of course, was the year George Steinbrenner died, so we could pass on the Yankees without tax, because somehow he knew that was the year to die. But they repealed it for just 1 year, and then the next year it came back in full. And they wanted to repeal it permanently, and the parliamentarian at the time said, you can't do it. I rule against you. And so Trent Lott fired him, and he brought back his predecessor, Alan Fruman, who was, like, you know, the old parliamentarian. And they actually went back and forth a few times in that job. But he brought back the old parliamentarian, and he said, okay, will you let us repeal the death tax now? We fired the guy who said we couldn't do it. And you know what he said? He said, no, he ruled the right way. You can't do it. He issued the exact same ruling as the guy they fired. And so I always warn people, like, you know, you might think firing the parliamentarian will get you a different outcome, but the problem might be the rules, not the person
right.
who's applying.
Well, and the other part of it, too, is that, you know, we saw what happens. You know, the Democrats decided to go for broke, and they got rid of the filibuster on judges because they wanted who they wanted, and they didn't want 60 votes. They wanted 50 plus one. And they blew up that rule. And then we got three Supreme Court justices.
Thank you very much. We'll get some Supreme Court
justices. Yeah, we got three Supreme Court justices.
I always thank Harry Reid for that.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, when people say, oh, the Republicans are in charge, what are they doing? They need to throw out the rules. It's like, well, there's a little caveat there. We're not going to be in charge forever. Yeah, it doesn't work like that. So we have to kind of be careful.
But anyway, the bottom line is we could not get it done in that bill, and so we got to figure out another way to get that done. And I really think we got to figure out a way to get that done before the end of this presidency, or else you have a real risk that all this deregulation can be reversed very, very quickly when a Democrat gets back in.
Yeah, and the 60 votes in the Senate, that filibuster, I mean, it saved us under Obama. There was so much stuff that didn't go through because we could block
them.
Yeah,
they would have passed a ton of stuff. But remember, they actually had 60 Democrats, and they really they got Obamacare and they got Dodd-Frank, but the other two big things they were trying to do
they
couldn't
get it done.
Union bill, they couldn't do it, and the cap and trade, they couldn't do it. And so they basically went 2-for-4. They were batting 500 on their gigantic, massive.
But there was a whole lot of other stuff that, that came during that time, and it was all
probably
locked.
A few more. Yeah, those are the four biggest.
Yeah.
From you know, kind of from the standpoint that I follow the economic stuff. I'm sure there were things in other policy areas too, like you know, gun control and you know.
Oh, there was a ton of stuff.
Who knows? I'm sure everything you can imagine they would have done if they didn't need the 60, because you know when you have 60, you can lose a lot and still have 50. You need to have unanimity to get to 60. I mean, the challenge, though, has been, you know, normally limited government people love the whole idea of the filibuster because it means, okay, government can't do very much because they can't pass bills.
Right.
But when the administration can do almost everything they want through regulation, now you've got a bit of a problem because the gridlock doesn't really save you from a lot. And so if we could sort of put the regulatory genie back in the bottle by saying that's going to have to go through Congress, too, then I would love gridlock again. Then it would be great.
Yeah, it's it makes it difficult to get things that we think are common sense, you know, to get that through without the 60 votes. And when things become as polarized as they are, they won't vote for, you know, they won't vote for the opposing teams.
Democrats don't vote for anything anymore. It's crazy. You know, we just had this big beautiful bill debate where. You know, we're trying to cancel a $4 trillion tax hike. You know, if nothing had happened, we were going to have every rate go up. We're going to have the standard deduction cut in half, the child credit cut in half. We're going to have the small business tax rate go from 29.6 to 39.6. And every single step of the way, the budget votes, the procedural votes, the actual bill, every single step of the way, every single Democrat voted no. So, you know, they didn't even, like, have their own alternative. You know, it was interesting, like, how different it was this time around. Because remember that... You know, when the Bush tax cuts were expiring, the Democrats were like, okay, we want to extend them for everyone except people over $250,000. Okay, so at least they were saying we want to extend them for most people. This time around, I didn't even see that. They weren't even putting alternatives up. They didn't have their own version. They weren't offering amendments. They were basically just saying no. So they actually wanted everyone's taxes to go up. That's kind of how radicalized the Democrats have become. And you know, we see this on almost every issue. So even the things that seem totally obvious, the number of Democrats that vote for them is, like, really small. Even when they voted on, like, no men and women sports, almost no Democrats voted for that. So, I mean, their party has become, you know, very, very far left and very disciplined in being so.
Yeah, which is a huge problem when you just try to get some regular stuff through. But if you vote with the other side, and the same goes for... The Republicans, you know, people will see if you voted with any Republican or any Democrats, then you're a sellout. So everybody's branded as a traitor. Kind of hard to move the needle a little bit. And then it all winds up being executive order, and you're exactly right. Big giant eraser shows up next, you know, with the next Democrat in the White House, and away it all goes.
The whiplash. That was all the other way. And actually, you know, that process itself, of things just swinging back and forth, that's very bad economically. Because
yes.
It's hard to make long-term decisions and investments and planning horizons need to be longer than 4 or 8 years. And so that's why I really think we need to bring stability back to it by saying, you know what, when the major rules of the road change, you got to prove that through a law, not just by
executive order.
Yeah,
it was never designed. I mean, our system was never designed to be run by a guy with a phone and a pen, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't work well that way. Laws are hard to get in and, you know, tougher to repeal sometimes. On the tax bill, you know, all we ever hear, I don't run in those circles, but all that you hear in the mainstream, you know, basic mainstream media is that, you know, it benefited the rich, right? Millionaires and billionaires, it was a tax cut for millionaires and billionaires. Can you kill that for us, please, from your vantage point?
The tax cuts, the original Trump tax cuts, which have now been made permanent, they were, in fact, the percentage of all income taxes that are paid by the 2022 with 45% of all income taxes.
Wait, you cut out during the really good part of that. Could you do that?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
The 2017 Trump tax cuts, which have now been made permanent, they actually were tilted towards the middle and the bottom in terms of their impact. They did cut taxes for everyone, but the best way to see sort of how they changed, look at the percentage, the share of all income tax revenue that was paid by the top 1%, and that actually went up to an all-time record high in 2022. It was over 45%, and it came down a little bit in 2023, but it was still over 40%, and that's the most recent year that we have data for. And so the rich are paying more of the overall tax burden than they ever have before. Now, some of that may come down, ironically, as a result of the thing that Democrats were demanding and asking for, which was this quadrupling of the SALT cap that was in this most recent bill. And so rich people in high-tax states are going to get a bit of a break that they didn't get in the first time around. But I think still overall, especially with the new things like the tax breaks on, you know, tax on tips, no tax on overtime, the new expanded deduction for seniors, overall this bill also is going to be pretty squarely aimed at the middle class, much more so than the rich. And so the thing that's amazing to me about this Democratic talking point is they will say it literally no matter what. It does not have to have any connection with reality. And the best proof of this is, remember in the beginning of the year when there was this big disagreement on strategy between the House and the Senate?
Mm-hmm.
The Senate was saying, let's do two bills, let's do one that's just defense and energy, and then we'll do another one later in the year that deals with tax. And when the Senate was trying to do that, they did a budget resolution that literally had zero tax provisions. There was no tax title. The Finance Committee didn't have any instructions. This was a budget that could not, in the way it was written, have any impact on taxes at all. And every single Democratic floor speech was, this is a tax cut for billionaires. they were going to say that literally no matter what. And so a bill that by definition could not have any tax provisions in it, they still use that talking point.
That's just sad, actually. And oddly enough, I queued up a song for that. I didn't realize it, but I did. I just thought it was a fun song. Because, you know, when your only tool is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And so anyway, we'll take a quick break. Come back with our guest, Phil Kirpin. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Laced up boots and faded jeans, a homemade sandwich, a half a jug of tea. Average Joe, the average pay, the same old end, the same old day. But there's nothing wrong with a hard hat and a hammer. Kind of glue and sticks this world together. Hands of steel and cradle of the promised land. God bless the working man.
This summer, stack the deck in your favor with a night of music, laughter, and Broadway magic with the Shasta College summer musical comedy Guys and Dolls. Be enthralled by the talents of over 30 singers and actors as they bring this Tony Award-winning classic to life with unforgettable songs, dazzling dancing, and fast-paced fun the whole family will enjoy. Evening performances run July 18th through the 26th, with two matinees on July 20th and 27th, and a special ASL show on July 24th at the Shasta College Theater in Reading. Tickets are $20 for general admission, $15 for seniors, and just $5 for students. Reserve your seats now at shastacollege.edu/artsevents. Have some cool family fun this summer with the classic and affordable live orchestra musical Guys and Dolls. Get your tickets today. See you at the show.
Now open at Turtle Bay Museum, Discover Steampunk, an exhibition for all ages.
Featuring futuristic technology inspired by 19th century Victorian designs.
Steampunk reimagines steam-powered machinery and gadgets as modern inventions. Discover Steampunk is on display at Turtle Bay Museum by the Sundial Bridge in Reading.
And is produced by the Imagine Team, free for members or included with paid admission.
Discover this and much more at turtlebay.org.
The property insurance crisis in California is starting to affect the business insurance property also. 200 to 300% rate increases in business property rates or not writing business insurance at all are becoming the norm. At Siskiyou Insurance, We have over 100 years experience in writing business insurance in the North State. We can help. We live here and care about our community and want to make sure that you keep your business with a local agent that knows our town and supports it every day. And we'll get you the best deal we can. Call Curtis Byron at Siskiyou Insurance Services, 530-224-2345 or 1-800-773-2345. Siskiyou Insurance, 530-224-2345 or 1-800-773-2345.
Struck by lightning sounds pretty frightening, but you know the chances are so small. Stuck by beeping, nothing but a beeping, better chance you're gonna buy at the mall. But it's a 23 or 4 to 1 that you can fall in love by the end of this song. So get up, tell the bookie to bet I'm not a damn thing will go wrong. The odds are that we will probably be alright. Odds are we gonna be alright. Odds are we gonna be alright tonight. The odds are that we will probably be alright. Odds are we gonna be alright. Odds are we gonna be alright for another night.
And we survived the tax bill. The big, beautiful bill. Millions didn't die. What about that, Phil? Didn't you like that one?
It's every policy debate we have now, the liberals say, we're all going to die. This is like their one note thing. It's pretty amazing. But yes, they were saying there are going to be tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of deaths if we have these horrible, vicious cuts to Medicaid. This is what they were saying. You know, there were no cuts. There were no cuts to Medicaid in this bill. In fact, Medicaid spending continues to grow at about 3% per year. It was up about 50% in the past 5 years. And, you know, even you try to impose any modest restraint at all, they go nuts. What are the Medicaid reforms in the bill? Well, there's a work requirement that says that if you're not disabled and you're working age, you've got to have 20 hours a week that you're either working in job training. And this is supposedly so cruel, and, you know, how could you require such a thing? It pulls about 80%, okay? And this is what they're going nuts about. Pretty modest. Reformed in Medicaid, they said you can't have state-directed payments in Medicaid to hospitals that are higher than what Medicare pays. So, you know, you can't, people who are on a welfare program, they can't be more attractive to hospitals than seniors that have been paying in their whole life. That's another very popular issue, and they're acting like, you know, this is crazy, I can do it. And the other thing is you can't have illegals that are on Medicaid, another super popular issue. And then the other thing that they did, I can't believe this even needed to be done, they deduplicated the Medicaid rolls under this bill, which has already been, they've started to implement it in the Trump administration. 2.8 million people were enrolled either in Medicaid in more than one state or were enrolled in both Medicaid and an Obamacare plan. 2.8 million people, which is pretty astonishing to me anyway. And they just said never. You know what that means? We were paying a managed care company double for no reason. Not like someone was getting health care for it. They were getting health care. You don't need to be in Medicaid in two different states to get your health care. And so I think that the this talking point, everyone's going to die from. By the way, there's not good evidence that being on Medicaid even improves your physical health. In fact,
yeah, no kidding.
In fact, on physical health, it improves your finances if someone else is paying for your health care. But it probably doesn't save any lives. And so, you know, it's just this hyperbole, this madness. They now just get their first go-to on everything. If Republicans want to kill everyone, I find it pretty ridiculous, but it's become their go-to.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to it becomes very difficult to have a conversation with people who are being told that because, where do you go with that? No, they're not all going to die, right?
It's very difficult.
Yeah,
to have every discussion. So, you know, this is, and healthcare policy is always hard. But the thing that drives me nuts, I don't understand how this is. Democrats somehow always have an advantage on the healthcare issue. Always, everything they do makes it worse. But somehow they always have an advantage. Republicans should be ashamed of that. And they should be, like, dominating the healthcare issue. Instead, they manage to always be losing that issue, despite the fact that everything Democrats have done has made it worse.
Yeah, it seems like it's very difficult to work on a major policy like that, because as soon as you bring it up, out comes the hue and cry of you're going to kill everybody. And I don't know how,
yeah,
you, I don't know how you make that stop.
I have to give them credit because they actually did more on health care than I would have expected in this bill. And they're already talking about doing another reconciliation bill later in the year that is going to focus on health care provisions. And we'll see. They're saying two things. The House Budget Committee Chairman, Jody Arrington, is saying the two things that he wants to do in the next reconciliation bill are what's called site payment reform in Medicare, which is to say Medicare would pay the same amount if you have a doctor's visit to a regular independent doctor that they pay if you go to a doctor that's been bought by a hospital system. And that would be huge, not only because it would save a lot of money, but it would stop this totally destructive consolidation trend that we've seen where the hospital systems just buy up every physician's group in town because the federal government will pay more for the same visit in the same office if it's called a hospital location than if it's just called the doctor's location. That is so crazy that we still haven't fixed that. So they say they want to fix that. And the other thing they say they want to do is fix this insane situation where you get seven times as much federal Medicaid money for an able-bodied working-age adult as you do for a disabled person or a child or a senior.
Wait, say
and
that again?
We could fix those seven times as much sign up an able-bodied working-age adult as when you sign up a pregnant woman, a child, or a senior, or a disabled person.
Wow.
Which is a crazy legacy of the that happened because of the Cornhusker kickback in Obamacare.
Oh,
and
I remember that.
You remember the senator from Nebraska said, "I am never going to vote for this bill. It's bad for my state budget." And you need to. And Harry Reid said, "Well, we'll pay 100% just for Nebraska." And then it became such a scandal that they ended up saying, "Well, the way that we'll fix it is we'll pay 100% everywhere for 3 years, and then we'll pay 90% everywhere forever." And that was their quote-unquote fix for the Cornhusker kickback.
God, I forgot about that.
They essentially nationalized it. And that's why we have this crazy formula where for the expansion population, which is able-bodied working-age adults, we have this massive federal overmatch where you can get for every dollar of federal money that you for state money that you spend, you get $9 of federal money, and it's only $1.33 for the traditional Medicaid population. So essentially it's seven times for the able-bodied working-age adults. It's seven times what it is for the actual vulnerable population, which, by the way, Obama himself tried to fix in his next budget after this dirty deal was done. He was kind of like, "Well, I didn't really mean that permanently. We're just trying to get the bill passed." So his budget proposal said to fix it, and, of course, they did not. They never did because they realized that, the states would not do the expansion if they had to pony up any significant amount of state funds, and so it just never got fixed.
Wow. Yeah, that's a problem. Well, and then states like California and a bunch of other ones cheat on the enrollment.
So they don't even put up the $1.
Yeah,
they
right.
basically get 100% federal funding by using this scam where they tax the managed care organization, basically the Medicaid contractor. They tax them. The federal government reimburses them for the tax, and then they use that as the state share. So there is no state share. It's a total scam that you have going there. They are trying to limit that a little bit in the Big Beautiful Bill, but it takes a while to phase in, and it's not really a perfect fix, but they do try to get at it, and so we'll see if that lasts or if it gets undone. But they did at least attempt to get at that issue.
Yeah, they're because that reconciliation bill was for last year's budget. So they still have this year's budget and next year. They could conceivably, by the midterm, they could do three reconciliation budgets or reconciliation bills.
Yeah, that's what they're saying. They're saying they want to do another one this year and then do one next year. And so we'll see if they can actually pull that off. It would be something. But the House Budget Chairman is saying the first two things he wants to do are fix the Medicaid funding formula and fix that site-neutral issue in Medicare. So those would be really good things to start with. And you know, I think on the tax side, I'd like to see them index the capital gains tax for inflation, because we've got so many assets now where, you know, if you sell them, you're going to get hit with a huge tax because of the big bulge of inflation that we had, even if there's no gain in terms of real purchasing power. So, and that's being talked about. And the president has said maybe to do it only for primary residences, but I'd like to see him do it for all assets. So we'll see. We'll see what happens with that.
Okay. And what about the whole interest rate thing? We keep hearing about that. You know, do you think that, I mean, obviously, I think it would help those of us who maybe want to refi our houses or things like that. But what's the upside and the downside?
I mean, I think that it's tough. I think that we are going to see the Fed cut probably once or twice before the end of this year, which, of course, has been, you know, the president's big push is to try to make that happen. But, you know, I'm not sure we're going to see long-term rates come down very much, and it's long-term rates that determine where mortgages go. And the reason long-term rates have been so stubborn is, you know, markets expect inflation to come back because there's so much federal debt, and you know we need to get a handle on that. You know, we need to get a handle on that federal debt problem, I think, to have a good chance of, you know, bringing down inflation expectations and solving that problem. So we'll see what happens with that. It probably depends on getting a little bit of discipline on the spending side. And, you know, we did see them cut NPR and PBS and foreign aid, and we'll see if we can get more spending cuts. But if we can bring down the federal spending trajectory a little bit with, you know, all the good tax and regulatory policy we have going on, I do think we're going to see long-term rates come down. But I think that the key is not going to be so much what the Fed does, which is really more short-term rates. But if we can get a little bit of discipline on spending, I expect that's what we'll see the long-term rates come down. So that's the big thing to look for and push for policy-wise.
Yeah, the hardest part with a lot of that is a huge percentage of our federal spending are programs that, you know, we're basically not allowed to talk about. You know, I mean, if you even mention the words Social Security, you're a heretic and you want to kill old people. The end.
Yeah, there's a lot to that, but if we can get the economic growth rate up, and I think we can do that with the good policies we have in place, especially as sort of the trade uncertainty lifts. So we can get the economic growth rate up. That drives a lot of the federal budget outlook. And if you can have some containment on the discretionary spending, the things that you can control, I think that the entitlement obligations become manageable if we're able to get the long-term growth rate up to 3%. And so get some discipline on the discretionary side, get some of these reforms, some of the mandatory things we can get a handle on, some of these healthcare programs, which are huge cost drivers. And if we can do those things, I think that the federal budget deficit, I mean, I don't think the debt's going to go away, but it becomes much more manageable if you've got incomes growing rapidly and you've got a larger economy, a larger denominator. So let's get the growth rate up and let's try to get some discipline on spending, and I think the debt becomes more manageable. And if that happens, inflation expectations will come down and so will the long-term interest rates.
Yeah. I totally agree with that. I think that it's funny because even people who want, you know, all of these things cut, they still want to know, well, when's the federal government going to come and do this, that, and the other thing? And it's like,
Well, the thing that drives me crazy about Social Security is we had a chance. We had a chance to fix it because it was running significant cash surpluses in the 90s and the early 2000s. And President Bush tried to do a program where you could put 4% of payroll into a personal account, which by now would have grown to be enormous. The average worker would have $150,000 or $200,000 in that account, and it's only been 20 years. And if you had, if you had 40 years for it to grow, you'd probably have $1 million in there. And, you know, and there were other proposals to put even more into personal accounts. I remember the Ryan Sununu plan was, I think, 6.4%. And we largely missed our chance on that because now, of course, Social Security is running annual cash deficit. And it's such a shame because that guy, they demagogued so hard, and Bush got attacked unmercifully for proposing that. And the Democrats had no alternative. They just killed it. And we missed our chance to solve that problem in a way that would have been really positive. People would have been better off rather than worse off, and the finances of the program would have been fixed.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, I was joking, but not really. I mean, it's one of those things you just about can't talk about. You're not allowed to discuss it.
And that was the lesson, right? Here we had a plan that actually would have solved the problem, and the guy got killed politically for it, and then everyone ran away from it, and so for 20 years, no one's even tried, right?
Well, I think it was Ron Johnson. Didn't he say something about Social Security? I mean, he uttered the words, and they pilloried him for, I don't know, 6 months. That went on. Yeah. I've always kind of laughed. I'm like, we need to call it like the Ferris Wheel Caucus. You know, and the Ferris Wheel Caucus secretly meets about Social Security, but we just don't say it.
Somehow he keeps winning in a tough state, so I like Ron Johnson.
No, I like him too, but he used the words Social Security, and that made him
public
enemy number one, right?
Oh, he got $10 million of AARP ads not dropped on his head. Which, by the way, they make $1 billion a year from United Health, and somehow they're missing in action while they're into criminal investigation, everything like that.
Huh.
So we could do a whole hour just on them.
Imagine that.
I'm not a big fan of that.
Well, let's tee that up, Phil. We have run out of time, but we know it's 5 o'clock somewhere, so we thought we'd send you off with a little Jimmy Buffett to enjoy your.
It's 5 o'clock here, so that's perfect.
That's
Thank
what
you.
I'm saying.
Great being with you guys.
Great.
Yeah.
Thanks,
Our
Phil.
Guest has been Phil Kirpin. You're listening to We the People. Join us at wethepeopleradio.us.
At a moment like this, I can't help but wonder, what would Jimmy Buffett do?
Funny you should ask, Alan.
I'd say, something tall and strong, make it a hurricane before I go insane. It's only 12:30, but I don't care. Pour me something tall and strong, make it a hurricane before I go insane. It's only 12:30, but
the news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.